From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Tomorrow is the 7th anniversary of the start of the Gulf War. We'll talk with a woman who was in Baghdad at the time and take a look at the American arms inspector Saddam Hussein has just forced out of Iraq. Then, surviving the bottom line, we'll examine Wall Street's power over corporate America and talk to two Cuban economists about the challenges their communist island faces in a capitalist world. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. American Scott Ritter and his UN weapons inspection team has left Baghdad after twice being blocked by Iraq from carrying out its work. Baghdad claims Ritter is a spy. The UN denies it's folding to Iraqi pressure, saying the team was leaving anyway. This news from Austin, Texas. Big Tobacco has apparently reached agreement with another state over health care costs. Sources say the industry has agreed to pay Texas at least $14 billion to settle the state's lawsuit. Details will be announced at a news conference in Austin later today. Texas is the third state to reach an out-of-court settlement with cigarette makers to recoup state money spent on treating smoking-related illnesses. The $14 billion would be the largest settlement to date, nearly matching agreements with Florida and Mississippi combined. In a related story, the trial judge in Minnesota's lawsuit against the tobacco industry appears ready to do a favor for the defendants. A pretrial hearing yesterday, the judge said it would be in the industry's favor if he barred it from claiming the state actually benefited financially from smokers' premature deaths. The state wants the testimony barred, but the industry wants to be able to rebut Minnesota's claims about how much money it has had to pay to treat smoking-related illnesses. The judge says any jury wouldn't buy tobacco's argument. He hasn't issued a final ruling. The state's suing for reimbursement of Medicaid money spent treating smokers. President Clinton is expected to announce another delay in implementation of the Helms-Burton Act today. The act gives Americans the right to sue foreign companies doing business on confiscated properties in Cuba, but Clinton can delay its implementation for six-month periods, and he's already done so three times. The White House says if the law takes effect, allies in Europe and Latin America won't cooperate fully in promoting democracy and human rights in Cuba. The European Union, Canada, and Mexico say Helms-Burton attempts to extend American law beyond its shores. South African apartheid-era President P.W. Botha will face a black magistrate when he's charged next week for defying an order to testify before the Truth Commission, this according to a court official today. Most judges and magistrates in South Africa are still white, but the government has said it's determined to redress the imbalance as quickly as practicable. Botha is to be prosecuted for defying a subpoena ordering him to testify before the Truth and Reconciliation Commission about the role of his National Security Council, a kind of war cabinet that helped implement emergency rule from 1986. Botha and the council presided over a draconian crackdown on black opposition in a last-ditch attempt to hold on to white minority rule. And a federal appeals court in Richmond, Virginia, has ruled white men can't sue when disparaging remarks are made about women and blacks. The 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled 6-6 yesterday that seven white Richmond policemen who had no right to sue over a supervisor's comments. A majority of the court was needed to overrule the lower court. The officers claimed the supervisor had created a hostile work environment, but the court said they were not directly injured by the remarks. The seven officers allege their immediate supervisor made insulting comments to and about female and black members of the city police force over a two-month period in 1993. A complaint to their precinct captain resulted in no action against the man, so the men filed a hostile environment charge with the Federal Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. This news from Spokane, Washington. A white separatist awaiting trial for a string of crimes may have known the Oklahoma City bombing was being planned days before the blast. Chevy Kehoe showed up at a Spokane motel April 19, 1995, about 45 minutes before the bomb went off and wanted to watch CNN. When a news bulletin reported the explosion, Kehoe was reportedly ecstatic and said it was about time. The former motel manager also claimed that Timothy McVeigh stayed at the motel when Kehoe a few months before the bombing. An FBI agent said the agency was interested in the man's comments but was unsure of his credibility. A federal psychiatrist is wrapping up her examination of Unabomber suspect Ted Kaczynski. The report on Kaczynski's competency to stand trial is due to go to the trial judge today. An abortion rights group says last year anti-abortion extremists attacked fewer abortion clinics and providers, but with more violence than in previous years. A week before the 25th anniversary of the Supreme Court decision legalizing abortion, the Feminist Majority Foundation released results of a survey. It found 25% of 339 clinics that responded to its survey said they experienced severe violence, including arsons, bombing, stalking, and death threats last year. And that's some of the news at this hour. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. An American-led team of UN arms inspectors left Baghdad today with a pledge to return, easing a standoff with Iraqi officials who'd refused to let the weapons experts work. UN officials said the team had planned to leave Iraq today anyway and insisted the departure was not a surrender to Iraqi pressure. "We'll be back," said Scott Ritter, the U.S. inspector Iraq has accused of espionage. He added this inspection team had important arms control tasks assigned to it, and these are still valid. Ritter and 15 other team members left the Iraqi capital by road for an airbase 40 miles west of Baghdad. They were to fly to Bahrain and then to New York. Iraq began barring Ritter's team from carrying out inspections on Tuesday. Iraqi officials said the team included too many U.S. and British inspectors. Other U.N. teams have continued their tasks. Charles Dulfer, the deputy chief of the inspection program, also said that sticking with the original departure date, even though inspectors were unable to carry out their tasks, was not buckling to pressure. Ritter had arrived in Iraq on Sunday. At the time, UN officials, who rarely comment on inspectors' schedules, did not specify a departure date. Meanwhile, UN Weapons Inspections Chief Richard Butler left New York yesterday for Baghdad to demand full access to all sites. He was to stop in Paris for talks with French officials who've offered additional French inspectors. We're joined right now in our Washington studio by Phyllis Bennis. She works with the Institute for Policy Studies and is author of the book Calling the Shots, How the United States Dominates the United Nations. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Phyllis.
Hi, Jamie.
Well, why don't we talk a little about who this Scott Ritter is? Why did Iraqi President Saddam Hussein single out Scott Ritter and say he could not lead one of the inspection sites, one of the inspection teams to Iraqi sites?
I think there are two aspects. One is symbolic, one is perhaps a little more real. The symbolic side is that Scott Ritter's particular area of expertise has to do with seeking out ways and means for the Iraqi government to hide evidence of their earlier research into efforts to create weapons of mass destruction. And that's an area that I think there has been some particular sensitivity on the Iraqi side. More significantly, though, Scott Ritter was a very useful symbol of the broader problem that the Iraqis have with the composition of the teams. It was a rather provocative move by the head of UNSCOM, the UN Special Commission, the Australian diplomat Richard Butler, who brought in a team of 15, of which 9 were Americans, and several more were Brits, were from Great Britain. And in that context, when there's been an ongoing debate about the imbalance, it's ironic, of course, because it's precisely because of the large number of U.S. chemical and biological warfare efforts itself that the U.S. Army and the U.S. military and Marines have so many of these experts compared to other countries in the world which don't have these experts because they don't have these weapons. So there's a certain irony in that side. But the reality is that the focus is far more on the issue of composition and access as general problems. Scott Ritter was really just a symbol of that. I think that there was a particular, another particular irony because of Ritter's own history back in 1992 when he was still in the Marines, only less than a year actually after the Gulf War, after Operation Desert Storm. It was Ritter who exposed how Norman Schwarzkopf's claim that the U.S. so-called smart bombs had managed to shoot down all of Iraq's Scud missiles and destroyed its fixed and mobile Scud launchers. And it was Ritter who said, "That's not true. We didn't get any of them." And that turned out to be the case.
Now, we can't know whether Scott Ritter is a spy or not today, as Saddam Hussein is alleging. But just simply the fact that he was working in U.S. military intelligence during the Gulf War, I mean, the U.N. has to know that this is a serious provocation to put him as head of a team. I mean, if you sort of reverse things and you had, if the war went the other way and you had an Iraqi intelligence expert leading a supposedly international team into White House-related facilities.
Well, this is, of course, exactly the basis for Jesse Helms and others who tried to stop the ratification of the Chemical Weapons Treaty here in the U.S. by claiming they wanted exemptions for things like inspectors from so-called rogue states who would be excluded by U.S. fiat from any international monitoring that the U.S. would otherwise be expected to accept. So this has some history in Washington as well. But I think if we look at it from the vantage point of justice, if there were justice in the world, this kind of provocative activity would not go on. If there were justice in the world, people in Iraq would not be starving under the regime of economic sanctions. But the reality is justice has not been a factor of how the U.S. has imposed the post-war ceasefire arrangements on Iraq. This has been an unjust arrangement from the beginning. The other problem, of course, is that Saddam Hussein is a very dictatorial, terrible leader in terms of any sense of accountability to the welfare of his own people. That has been shown over and over again, and I don't think that we can pretend otherwise. In that context, it becomes much more difficult for the Iraqi government to claim that it's somehow a matter of justice to carry out such provocative actions. But I think the bottom line goes to the party in power. That's not Iraq. The party in power here is the United States.
And what about Richard Butler, the head of the whole UNSCOM, the UN, the whole operation that's investigating the sites in Iraq? Richard Butler, who comes from Australia. Actually, he was formerly the Australian ambassador to Indonesia. Indonesia, the only country in the world that recognizes the annexation of East Timor by Indonesia. So he maintained a very close relationship with the dictator there. What about the rest of his history?
Well, he also has a history in arms control. He came to the United Nations with a long brief of arms control work in multilateral settings. When he first began, he was greeted with a great deal of respect and a certain amount of relief because his predecessor, Ralph Ikaias, had been widely viewed as being very passive relative to U.S. pressures to orchestrate the work of UNSCOM, the U.N. Special Commission, which is the monitoring operation in Iraq, in different ways. Butler is a very independent character. He also, though, has a very brash style. He is not only not one to walk away from a confrontation, but it's not so clear that he wouldn't start a confrontation in his own right in terms of a certain swaggering positioning. So the notion of creating his teams knowing that certain things might be provocative is not so much out of character for Richard Butler.
We're talking to Phyllis Bennis. She's a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and author of Calling the Shots, How the United States Dominates the UN. In just a second, we're going to go to a woman who was in Iraq when the United States bombed it was actually January 16th, 1991, January 17th, to be exact. But before that, Phyllis, what about the latest news about the possibility of human and animal experimentation? At least according to some reports, UN spokespeople said that they found pictures, a cache of pictures provided, but they say it provides no proof that Iraq has conducted chemical and biological weapons tests on humans. Iraq has in the past acknowledged testing chemical and biological tests on animals before the UN ordered those weapons destroyed in 91. Ewan Buchanan, a spokesperson for the UN Special Commission Iraq, said a photograph was found showing a human arm covered with lesions, but said it's unclear where or when the picture was taken, and the media, I think, is going to town on this one.
The media is going to town. The UN has been very clear that there is no photographic evidence, despite the claim on CNN to the contrary, of chemical weapons testing on human beings. There is a single photograph that shows an arm with lesions. There's no evidence about what caused the lesions, how they came to be there. It's just not evidence. There is evidence in the past, and the Iraqis had acknowledged this long ago, of testing these weapons on animals. I think that we have to get past these kinds of volatile, media-driven, sometimes I would say hysterical reactions, and get down to the level of realities. And I think the one thing that we have to look forward to is the possibility of a new diplomatic initiative, which actually had begun being discussed in Paris by, among others, the high-ranking U.S. official Tom Pickering, number three in the State Department, which would call for not only easing the economic sanctions of Iraq, that part probably isn't going to be acknowledged for a while, but most importantly, would allow the Iraqis to see that there is light at the end of the tunnel for the arms sanctions regimes in the form of acknowledging what the UN has been saying for quite some time, that the danger of Iraqi nuclear and missile technology is over, that they are no longer threats that need to be worried about by the UN. The concentration would shift solely to chemical and biological, but with a regime put in place that would look towards long-term, even permanent monitoring, much less intrusive, but with the understanding that this is going to go on for a very long time, because as we know, what it takes to create chemical weapons is basically a high school chemistry lab. It's not something that's so complex. It's very easy to do. Long-term monitoring may be required, but it will not be the kind of intrusive, chaotic monitoring that is now linked to the economic sanctions that is wreaking so much havoc among the population of Iraq. If this could go forward after the current crisis eases, this new initiative by the French and the Russians, and if Tom Pickering would go along with it and recognize the validity of it, there is some possibility that this current cycle of crisis, relaxation, renewed crisis might be ended once and for all.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Phyllis Bennis, for being with us, fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and author of Calling the Shots, How the United States Dominates the UN. We're also joined on the phone on the 7th anniversary of the beginning of the Gulf War. Actually, the bombs started dropping, the missiles started flying tomorrow in the United States, which was actually January 17th in Iraq. We're joined by Kathy Kelly, founder of Voices in the Wilderness. She was in Iraq during the war and has repeatedly returned and led a group called Voices in the Wilderness, various U.S. citizens who have gone to Iraq to challenge the U.S. embargo. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Kathy.
Hello, Amy.
Well, can you tell us what it was like 7 years ago?
Amy, I remember that the night when the war broke out, we all came out of our tents. We were in a border camp on the border between Saudi Arabia and Iraq, 73 people from 18 different countries, and up to the last minute had still held out some kind of hope that perhaps it wouldn't erupt into warfare. But I remember that as these planes flew overhead, it seemed like one every 5 minutes, every dog in the region started to bark, and those dogs barked themselves hoarse. And I always felt that that was the most appropriate response to what was surely one of the cruelest, the most lethal and destructive and vindictive warfares. And certainly it hasn't ended yet. It continues.
Why did you decide to go then?
I felt that it was important to have some representation of the most vigorous opposition to the war. And, you know, soldiers are required to lay down their lives for what they believe in. And I think in our peace movement, we have to at times be willing, well, maybe all the time, be willing to say that in order to resist the kinds of injustices that Phyllis has pointed out so well, we need to put our lives on the line.
Now, you've returned how many times since then?
I've returned five times since my first arrival in Iraq, and have gone in the last year 3 times to places where we've had a chance to be with families, to be with children, and to understand much better that as the political games playing goes on, innocent children continue to suffer relentlessly.
Kathy Kelly, what do you say to those who say this is Saddam Hussein's fault? If Saddam Hussein would stop being as belligerent as he is, if he'd allow arms inspectors in and full investigation of all that the UN and the United States wants to investigate, then the embargo would be lifted and the children would not die.
I think that anyone who prevents the embargo from being lifted bears a very, very heavy responsibility. But, Amy, I think we need to keep our eye on the ball, more or less, and I think the ball is oil. My sense, over 7 years of these sanctions dragging on and on with no indication that they've had any effect on their stated goals, my sense is that the sanctions are in place for an entirely other reason, that the reason is to keep Iraq out of the oil market, that for a number of reasons it's advantageous to the United States and to some of its allies not to have that Iraqi oil on the market. As long as you have a demonized Saddam Hussein, then they have a very good excuse to keep Iraq out of the oil market, and as long as Iraqi oil isn't on the market, then the Saudis, for instance, can charge a little bit more per barrel. That revenue enables them to purchase our top crop. And what's our top crop? It's weapons. And so I think for oil-based profits, for weapon-based profits, people in some very, very powerful places have been willing to sacrifice the lives of children to more or less create the most impossible of conditions, to say to a group of people, look, you either force your government to unconditionally surrender to every demand that our government makes of you, or we're going to slaughter 5,000 more of your children this month. And if you don't believe it, then you check your census from last month. Now, this, I believe, is what the United States has been saying to Iraqi people. And doesn't this inspire all around the Arab world and in many other parts of the world real fear and terror even of the cavalier and dangerously dispassionate view that United States policymakers can have toward children under the age of five? And I think that it has isolated the United States in a way that is not at all positive for the future of U.S. people.
Kathy Kelly, we have to break. When we come back, I want to quickly ask you about the protest of others in your group, Voices in the Wilderness, that just took place yesterday in Baghdad outside the U.N. headquarters there. And then we're going to go on to look at the economy in this country. We're going to look at Wall Street's power over corporate America. And finally, we'll go down to Cuba to talk with two communist economists. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back with Kathy Kelly, founder of Voices in the Wilderness, in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we wrap up our conversation with Kathy Kelly in Chicago, she's founder of Voices in the Wilderness, which has led many groups to Iraq over the last 7 years to challenge the U.S. embargo. Kathy, two questions. One is about this protest that took place yesterday. Why in front of UNSCOM headquarters, the U.N. inspection team headquarters?
Well, three members of our 10th delegation to Iraq wanted to express remorse and regret for the terrible suffering that's been caused by these sanctions. And I guess in a way the intent is to say, look, inspect by all means, peer into the pediatrics wards of the hospitals and see the results of the most grave, the most tragic means of massive warfare. And that's the result of the economic sanctions, which are themselves a weapon of mass destruction. And so they're just getting a tiny portion of the kind of hunger that's been inflicted on Iraqi people by fasting for 3 days. But it was a way to express something that we very much have wanted to express, that people here need to have that window of understanding of what it means to have the most bare and meager rations available to your children and to watch your children wither away from malnutrition and starvation. And they're joined by people in 24 other cities across North America who've also been engaged in vigils and in fasts and in recognition that the war has not yet ended. And so our hope is that people will feel some of the passion that these travelers to Iraq bring back, to recognize that we are really all part of one another, and to work as hard as we can to help this generation of Iraqi children that are alive today to survive beyond the warfare that's being waged against them. They're innocent. And we really would welcome anyone to get in touch with us here in Chicago. We're reachable by phone at 773-784-8065.
And Kathy, finally, we spoke to members of, I think it was the 9th delegation that went to Iraq just about a month ago when they'd returned, and several of them had everything taken from them, videotapes, their diaries, when they came in through U.S. Customs. Have they gotten them back, and has the U.S. Treasury Department provided a reason for those confiscations?
I guess they were confiscated because they're considered intellectual property, and legally you can't bring intellectual property back from Iraq. I think when that team returned, they really were brilliant, because the question was, do these materials give evidence of a crime having been committed? Now, we never try to hide the fact that we travel in open and public violation of the sanctions. We've been doing that since January of 1996 when we launched this campaign, and all 10 delegations have been very clear about what we're doing and why. But we think, yes, those materials gave evidence of a crime. The video from Basra shows the criminal nature of these sanctions and how it has really created a crime against humanity, against innocent civilians who are walking around in streets that are filled with backup sewage, children dying in hospitals. And so we're going to still struggle to get those materials back and hope that someday it'll be much easier to educate people here in the United States about the consequences of actions taken in our name.
Kathy Kelly, I want to thank you for joining us. Can you give us the number of Voices in the Wilderness, which you founded in Chicago, Illinois?
Well, thank you. A number of us got together on that, really, and it's 773-784-8065, and we'd welcome any calls, comments, advice, or help.
And I assume you're going to be continuing these delegations to Iraq?
Oh, yes, yes. We hope in late February. There's a couple from Portland, Maine, and a couple of other people ready to go. And we think it is important to keep on trying to have people come back to the United States and say, look, this is what we've seen and heard.
Well, Kathy Kelly, thanks for being with us on this 7th anniversary of the Persian Gulf War. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
In America today, it's out with the old.
I felt I had something to offer society.
And in with the new.
I've done 9 major restructurings, and I can tell you categorically, this was the worst.
Wall Street values reign supreme.
We are only loyal to our money.
The powerful reap the rewards.
That's another $600 million. So we made $1 billion on Sunday with no risk.
The middle class feels the squeeze.
You're hired as a temp. When they're through with you, they let you go.
You know, why is it so hard to just have a stable job?
We have a choice, winner take all.
I'm a great believer in predators.
Or share the gains.
I don't see it as surrendering power.
And that is the beginning of a new PBS documentary that will be airing throughout the country this weekend, beginning today in some markets and around the country on the weekend, called Surviving the Bottom Line. It begins with Hedrick Smith, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, noting that over the past 6 years, America has had steady growth, more jobs, colossal profits, and a record-shattering bull market on Wall Street. But he also observes that the same economic earthquake that's generated enormous new wealth for the already affluent has deepened the economic fault line that divides our society. And Hedrick Smith joins us now in our Washington studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy. How are you?
Good. Well, tell us about this very interesting 4-part documentary, 2 hours each, that's going to be airing around the country this weekend, looking at the economy and how Wall Street runs corporate America.
Well, I think, Amy, I began my work on this with my colleagues, Mark Schaefer and Barry Goodman, Chris Koch and David Murdoch, the other producers. Thinking, as many Americans do, that we're in an economic situation where pretty much the behavior of people at the top of the economy is driven by globalization, by technology, by the information age, and there's not a lot that we can do about it except try to cushion the shocks for us individually here and there. And we emerged, I think, after 14 months of work feeling that that's very much not the case, that there is a choice, that we can go another way, that there are corporations and communities and companies that are sharing the gains much more widely, that are sharing power, that are working labor management partnerships, private public sector partnerships, that there are educational systems that are working more effectively, and that, as some of the people in the film say, and particularly even some of the corporate leaders like Henry Schacht of Lucent Technologies, the chairman of Lucent Technologies says, we cannot continue to go on with the enormous disparity of wealth in this country, which has become more exaggerated in the years of growth over the last 6 years instead of spreading the wealth, and that if this is going to blow up in our faces. And that's Henry Schacht talking. And I think that there is some realization among some of the corporate leaders that that things have gone too far and that some redress is necessary, and also that there is another way. I think that's one thing. The second thing is we've really got a good sense and tried to convey it of some of the price for ordinary people, not just the price in terms of making less money, having lower wages than they had before, but the uncertainty in their lives of temp work, of part-time work, of constantly bouncing from one job to another, the strain on families where the market is demanding so much of their time and energy to hang on to their jobs that they have a tough time raising their kids and having a personal life. So there's a loss in terms of quality of life. And that's the story we've tried to tell. It's a story, in many ways, as much about the values that are driving our economy. And I don't mean monetary values. I mean philosophical and ethical values that are driving our economy. It's much more about that than it is about economic statistics.
You begin the series with Running with the Bulls, which is a look at Wall Street in action, and you particularly look at mutual fund managers. Now, for a lot of people who are not conversant in economics, they don't understand what this is, but also how powerful these people are.
Well, a lot of us, I think, it took history or know something about the 19th century, and we think about the robber barons. We think about people like Andrew Carnegie, who put together huge deals, J.P. Morgan, who put together U.S. Steel. So we have some notion of the power of financial managers to create corporations and to move great assets around. I think today we are seeing the leaders of some of the largest mutual funds in America exercising that same kind of power, except they're much less visible. People are much less aware of them. Michael Price is primary among them. He runs a mutual fund series in New Jersey, which controls roughly $25 billion of assets. The story in particular which we tell about Michael Price is that he is the guy who triggered the merger between Chase Manhattan Bank and Chemical Bank in New York, which was the biggest bank merger in a slew of bank mergers. He is the man who has brought Al Dunlop, known as Chainsaw Al, because he saws off parts of corporations, sells them off. From his perspective, he makes them more efficient. He brings them back from near death with radical surgery. From the perspective of others, he's destroying value. But nonetheless, it was Price who brought Al Dunlop into Sunbeam Corporation, where Dunlop is now about 18 months into a major restructuring. So Price is the Svengali. He's the guy behind the scenes that you don't see. And what we've tried to do in the beginning of our series, which was brilliantly produced by Mark Schaefer, we have tried to show the story of how a guy like Michael Price exercises his influence on corporate America, and then how that ricochets through the corporate system and affects the lives of workers, of managers, of communities in various places from Florida to McMinnville, Tennessee, to Hattiesburg, Mississippi, to Mexico. This is an effort to get behind the way power has shifted in our economy, even from the corporate boardroom and the CEO's office to the financial managers on Wall Street.
Hedrick Smith, can you talk a little about ValueJet as an example of how Wall Street works and really threatens our lives?
Well, what's interesting is that a lot of people looked at ValueJet quite properly when the terrible crash took place in the Florida Everglades as an example of a corporation that had outsourced too much of its maintenance work. You remember the fatal canisters of oxygen that got put in the freight hold below the plane, which apparently triggered a fire and blew up and caused the crash. So there was a great deal of focus on, did the FAA adequately supervise ValueJet, and was ValueJet or was one of its subcontractors responsible for that crash? But as we looked at it, we began to see the hand of a larger force, and that is Wall Street, because ValueJet was a company that was actually set up almost perfectly to Wall Street's specifications. It was a virtual company. Cost-cutting was the very heart of that company. There was a tiny little central office, central staff. They hired enormous numbers of temporary and part-time workers. They outsourced almost all of their maintenance work and a lot of their other work. They took pilots who, in some instances, had less training. They promoted pilots who had less training than was normal in other airlines. They cut corners in every direction. And, of course, Wall Street loved it because the fares were low, the costs were low, the growth of the company was extraordinarily fast. It shot up like a rocket. The original owners each put up $1 million. Four owners, $4 million, and about 18 months later, each one's $1 million was worth $200 million. So tremendous gains. But what got sacrificed in the process, according to Mary Schiavo, the former inspector general at the Department of Transportation who investigated the crash and the airline even before the Everglades crash took place, what got sacrificed, according to her and others, was safety. And 110 people paid the ultimate price for that in the Florida Everglades. But there were other accidents before that. So here you have the influence of a value system in the market, which is fast growth, fast profits, cut costs, outsourcing. Those are all things that Wall Street has been driving on corporate America, particularly over the last decade. And in this particular instance, you can see very clearly the impact of it. And we talked to the Wall Street analysts about it. Do you ever worry about safety? Do you look at things like that? And, of course, they say, in retrospect, maybe we should have. But, no, we were watching the stock price. We were looking at profits. We were looking at other indicators. Safety is not our business, is the answer.
Hedrick Smith, you contrast that with Northwest Airlines.
Well, Northwest Airlines is terribly important. And at least from our perspective in this series, we're trying not just to look at problems, but we're also trying to look at solutions, people who've done things another way. And Northwest is a very heartening story. Back in 1993, Northwest was on the verge of bankruptcy. It was going down the drain. They literally had lawyers and their executives in the court in Delaware within hours of filing bankruptcy. A $9 billion airline with 47,000 employees was going to go. And what saved it was the concessions made by the trade unions, by the airline pilots, by the flight attendants, the machinists, by others. At the airline, they made concessions worth $900 million in wages and work rules in order to give the company a new lease on life, in order to enable it to get loans from its creditors and to keep operating. And what's happened in the interim is fascinating to watch, because the leadership, the corporate leadership, the management and the owners were willing to give up 30% ownership to the workers, bring three labor union members, representatives, onto the board of directors, and also to open up a lot of the decision-making process in that airline. They now insource work they used to outsource. They've got a huge project, which the FAA requires, of changing the pylons on the B-747 airliners. Those are the things that hold the engines on the plane. There have been a few crashes where engines have fallen off planes. The FAA said that's got to be fixed. Northwest was going to ship that work, $80 million of work, to Singapore to get it done cheaply. The machinists and management sat down. The machinists said, hey, let us take a look at that. Let us see if we can't do that work more cheaply and better and keep it in America and keep the jobs in America. And the management said, okay, we'll open our books. They call it the open kimono policy. We'll show you everything we have, which is a very unusual attitude for an American management to take. They worked together, and they kept the jobs in America, and the job is being done better. The chairman of the board, John Dasberg, says he feels fortunate to have labor members on his board. In fact, he voluntarily suggested that they extend their terms on the board of directors for 10 years beyond what was required in the original agreement, because he found it such an asset to have the pipeline of information, to have a connection with his workforce, to have the engagement, the loyalty of the people in a way that made Northwest operate better. Now, that's an example of exactly the opposite of ValueJet. This is an inclusive, collaborative partnership, and ValueJet is do it for quick profits, get the payoff, big stock options, big payoff, you know, for a small group of owners. Totally different way of operating.
Hedrick Smith, we just have a minute. You use the interesting comparison of this country to Holland.
Well, Holland has a lot of temporary and part-time workers the way we do. But what's interesting is they give them the same safety net, the same benefits that regular workers have. So there's a much greater sense of security in the Dutch middle class and the working class. There's a better sense of cohesion. And employers don't have the incentive to use part-time and temp workers in order to get rid of having to pay the benefits. It's a much more even way to go. And hopefully that example is one that will intrigue people. And there are examples in education, lots of others, Amy. We don't have time to go into them. But there are lots of good stories there, as well as some very tough reporting on the hard times that individual people have had in very human ways. I think people will identify with this series. They'll see themselves in the people we've talked about, particularly women, younger couples, men in their 50s, older people getting laid off, in trouble, jumping from one job to another at the end of their careers. This is a very much of a people's series. It's about people. It's not about money. It's not about statistics.
Well, Hedrick Smith, I want to thank you very much for doing this. People can see this on their PBS station this weekend at different times, so just check your listings. The documentary is called Surviving the Bottom Line and examines Wall Street's power over corporate America. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, an interesting contrast to this discussion, two communist Cuban economists. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Today we continue our Conversations in Cuba series with two communist economists I spoke with in Havana just a few weeks ago. We're joined by Pedro Monreal, professor and researcher at the Center for the Study of the International Economy at University of Havana, and Julio Carranza, professor and researcher at the Center for the Study of Cuban Economy, also at the University of Havana. And I talked to them about the challenges of a communist island in a capitalist world. Also, I should say that Pedro Monreal, he speaks in English, and he also translates for Julio Carranza when Professor Carranza speaks.
Why don't we start with just your assessment of the Cuban economy today. What I see coming down to Havana for the first time and reading about the Cuban economy over the years is this two-tiered system, the dollar economy and the peso economy. Can you talk a little about how this evolved and where it's at today?
Well, in this moment, the Cuban economy is in its fourth year of recovery since the crisis that began in 1990.
And that started with the collapse of the Soviet Union?
Yes, basically, yes. Although before that, the Cuban economy was having its own problems, basically related to problems with efficiency of the economy. The fact is that the problems in the former socialist countries of in Europe and the fall of the Soviet Union in 1991 mean a severe blow to the Cuban economy.
How much money was Cuba actually getting from the Soviet Union?
It's difficult to say because there were several mechanisms involved in the transfer of resources from the Soviet Union to Cuba. But in any case, it has been estimated above $5 billion per year. It includes everything. It includes credits, but also transfer in the form of prices, higher prices for Cuban products, lower prices for Russian products. From 1990 to 1993, the Cuban economy contracted by around between 35 to 40% the GDP of the Cuban economy, that is the gross domestic product. So the contraction of the Cuban economy was really very impressive. And in 1994 began a modest recovery, and now we are in the fourth year of this process of recovery. Although the fact is that we are having problems with one of the most important industries in Cuba, which is the sugarcane industry, that this year, 1997, we had a very bad sugar harvest. So still we are trying to recover from the levels that we used to have in 1989. This is basically the most important assessment in terms of a general overview of the economy. In those years, several changes has been implemented in Cuba. First, in terms of sectors, we have seen in the last 7 years the emergence of tourism as one of the most important economic activities in Cuba. This is fact now one of the pillars of the Cuban economy. And also we also have had important changes in terms of the institutions, in terms of new laws, new regulatory frameworks that has been open spaces to certain private activities, to a reform in the agricultural sector, and also this establishment of a two-tier economy in which the dollar is accepted as a currency for certain activities in certain places. It is now a more mixed economy than it used to be 7 years ago, but still there is a lot of changes that still are needed in order to sustain the recovery of the economy.
And Professor Carranza, what is your assessment of the impact of the dollar economy?
En Cuba ha habido un proceso de dolarización de la economía que se hace muy fuerte después del año 1993.
We have had in Cuba a process that we call the process of dollarization that began in earnest in 1993 when the Cuban government decided to legalize a de facto situation that existed in the country where many citizens were using anyway dollars for certain activities. Since then, we have had this dual economy where there is a coexistence between a peso economy, that is a national currency economy, and we also have a dollar economy, given that the dollar has been used for a wide variety of activities in the country. Well, basically, there are three main sources for these dollars that the ordinary Cuban has. The first source is related to the remittances that many Cubans are receiving from his relatives abroad, basically in the Florida, South Florida. A second source is related to tourism, which is also an activity that has a kind of a spillover effect on certain Cubans. And third, we also have as a source of dollars for the Cuban population, foreign investment and related activities of foreign enterprises in Cuba that are generating enough dollars to pay Cubans. In fact, according to the figures that has been provided by Cuban authorities in terms of the total amount of sales are conducted in Cuba in U.S. dollars, those figures indicate that those sales has been transformed in one of the most important mechanisms in order to get the dollar for hard currency for the Cuban economy. One of the most important sources of hard currency for the Cuban economy now is precisely sales in dollars, in Cuban stores. So in the short term, it has been clearly one a situation, a process that it's having a positive effect in the sense that has been allowed the Cuban government to have access to those hard currency income. But it's true that in the long term, the problem is much more complicated because in the end, what the country needs is a comprehensive economic system in which only one currency circulates, that is the Cuban peso. So this is a challenge for the future.
How can that be accomplished, one currency circulating?
No, esto es una pregunta fundamental y la respuesta es compleja porque hay diferentes opiniones acerca de cómo resolver esta situación.
That's a fundamental question. And the fact is that this is a very controversial issue because there are different alternatives in order how to proceed with that. Most Cubans do agree that we need, for sure, in the future, just one currency circulating in the country. However, there are different opinions in terms about how to do that. There is one field, one school of thought, to use the phrase, that thinks that this is something for the future, something for the long term, but that in the short term, there is no other alternative than having this dual system. However, there is another current of opinion, like we, and that thinks that this is something that have to be done in the short term, that the advancing to a unified monetary system is something that we need now.
We see the situation now in Cuba where you have doctors making, a number of pesos equivalent to $20 a month, and you have the waiters at hotels or people who work in the hotels making perhaps $200-$400, talking about U.S. dollars, maybe even in a week. How is that going to change the nature of society? We also see people who've been long-time workers switching over to the tourist economy, like operating taxis, either legally or illegally, because they can get their hands on dollars. It seems that it's going to change more than the economy, but the whole sociology of the country.
Well, just to clarify one point, the fact is that the level of real salaries that Cuban has is not totally dependent on the amount of money they are paid. I mean, it's higher than their nominal salaries because important services in Cuba, such as health and education, as I provided free of charge. So even if a physician is earning 400 pesos and these 400 Cuban pesos are equal to, let's say, 20 US dollars, in fact, is his or her real salary is higher than these 20 pesos. But it's true that given that all Cubans has the same benefits, free education, free health, it's true that those person that only has an income, a fixed income in Cuban pesos, are in disadvantage compared with people, let's say workers in the tourism sector, that receive part of tips or something in her currency. So this is one of the most important problems that we have now, we have in Cuba, and not only because it means that there is no way now to structure the system of incentives depending on the quality of the work and the complexity of the job you are doing. That is, it is not conceivable that a country could move forward if you are physicians, you are engineers, you are whichever you have graduates for the university are earning less than a people that is driving a taxi or flipping hamburgers. So
And it's not to put down those people in the tourist industry, but just when, I mean, if it's one thing if it was equal, but it's so far disproportionately, you know, out of proportion.
Well, that's precisely the problem. That in order to have an efficient economy, an economy that has the right incentives to grow, you need that people need to be compensated in terms of their actual job. And this is one of the problems that is related to this dual economy. That is, if you have an economy where you have products that you sell in dollars, but you are not paying people with the same currency, you have immediately this problem. And technically, there are several approaches to correct that situation. But to begin with, I think that one of the most important elements or actions in any correction should be the integration of the economy in just one monetary system, unified monetary system. And that will allow more room in order to ordinate that.
Let's step back for a second with the point you raised about when we say $20 or $30 or $40 a month, which would shock Americans, you know, how can you get by on that, that you're also talking about other services being completely taken care of. What is that equivalent to? Have you, as economists, monetized that to let us know what it means to have a low salary but have all of the rest taken care of?
A mí me parece que eso es una precisión importante porque hay una cantidad de servicios que en Cuba se reciben de manera gratuita y en otros países.
Well, this is an important aspect that needs to be clarified, because precisely in Cuba, given that the Cuban citizens has for free certain services such as education and health, and also most of the Cuban population receive at subsidized prices a given amount of food and other products, it is important to have in mind, to bear in mind, that in real terms, the salary of most Cubans are higher than those level of $20 or $30 could suggest to an audience outside Cuba. So that's the point. Having said that, however, there is an important issue, which is that there are current tensions, because the prices of a certain number of products, being that nominated in U.S. dollars or being that the prices of product sales in the free markets, those prices are very high and they are out of proportion with the real level of income of most Cubans. So this is a basic tension in the Cuban economy now and the Cuban society now. In the last 2 years, there has been certain correction in this tension, in the sense that the level of prices has been reduced somehow, and there is a better proportion between prices and salaries than it used to be 2 years ago. But however, this difference it exists still. It is something that needs to be corrected in the near future. So this is a very complex situation, because of, I said before, basic services to the population and part of the distribution of products to the population has been subsidized or are free, but at the same time, this is a process in which we have a still a clear and important tension between prices and income, and this is a very difficult situation for most of the population still.
Pedro Monreal and Julio Carranza, both professors at the University of Havana. Pedro Monreal is a researcher at the Center for the Study of International Economy. Julio Carranza, a researcher at the Center for the Study of the Cuban Economy. I spoke with them last week in Havana, where I went to look at how Cuba was preparing for the Pope's visit and simply to look at the state of Cuba today. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. We'll continue our Conversations in Cuba series next week as Pope John Paul II makes his way to Cuba. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin and Sammy Lee Webster-Wu. Errol Maitland engineered from New York. Joe Gill engineered from Washington. Production help from Bruce Wayne Adams. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!